So thanks a lot for the introduction and for the invitation to speak at the conference. It's great to be back in Marseille. So I want to do a quick run through on bone disorders, really focusing on therapeutic management as the title of the session. These are my disclosures. So the issue around bone disease and HIV is really one of age, and the relevance of bone disease to the population that you're caring for is really relevant to the proportion of people in your population who are reaching the age where this becomes important. So for bone disease, you look at things like spinal infections, kick them when you're around the mid-50s. Once you start getting to hip infections, which are of much more serious morbidity and mortality associated with them, they really don't kick in until people are in their 70s. So the vast majority of people living with HIV really won't have immediate implications from bone disease in terms of clinical outcome. But you look at some of the established populations around the world, and you can see that, for example, in well-established epidemics like in Spain and the US, you're getting upwards of 50% of people living with HIV now reaching the age over 50, where this starts to become a clinically relevant issue. And their proportion of female patients that are reaching menopausal status, which is also a threshold for bone disease in the general population, also differs between populations, but in some cases, like countries like the US, you're also seeing prevalence rates approaching 50 years of age. Fractures are more common. There's a lot of studies that have shown that really regardless of the age of the population that you look at, that when you look at fractures in people with HIV, they're occurring at higher prevalence. Whether that's because of BMD or what the contribution of bone mineral density is to the fractures is still to be determined, but there's a consistent signal of fracture spread right across age groups and both genders. So low BMD is more prevalent in people living with HIV. Many studies have shown this. I've just shown data from one of our cohort studies that we've constructed in Dublin called the HIV Upbeat Study. So this is a group that comprises people living with HIV and a relevant group of people without HIV drawn from similar demographic backgrounds. So we've tried to match socio-demographically rather than matching on things like age or gender. What this enables us to do is to determine the relative contribution of HIV once you correct for other important confounders. So as with a lot of other studies, as this slide shows, we do see a higher prevalence of low BMD in those with HIV. So you're seeing roughly a quarter of patients living with HIV having low BMD compared to just over 10% in the HIV negative group. But we're also able to model the relative contribution of both known risk factors such as gender, age, ethnicity, but also HIV. And you can see that when you correct for all of these other risk factors that have been associated with low BMD, you still get a significant association between HIV and low BMD. So how do we go about managing this? Well, I'd like to touch on three points. The first is prevention. So prevention is always better than the cure, and I think that's good for comorbidities and HIV. The second thing is whether you can actually reverse or treat low BMD that's established in people living with HIV. And then the third thing is just maintaining bone health in people as they get older. So in terms of prevention, the bottom line is to start preventing issues around low BMD, the first thing you've got to do is to know who has low BMD in the first place, and that involves screening. Now, EACs for a number of years now have had very clear guidelines in terms of who should be screened for low BMD, and the best way to screen for low BMD is still a DEXA scan. So doing vitamin D, PTH levels, they don't tell you anything really about underlying bone density. So these are the seven categories that EACs have described, and they're in fairly good consensus with similar guidelines from the US. So you're looking at postmenopausal women, men over the age of 50, those with a high fracture risk who are under 50, a history of low impact fracture, those at high risk for falls, clinical hypogonadism, i.e. symptomatic hypogonadism, and those with a history of significant steroid exposure. Now, if we quickly go back to this graph, you'll see that when you start looking at these seven criteria and you reflect on the population of people that you're treating, I can guarantee that almost everyone in this room is under screening for BMD within your population. So rather than getting too obsessed with what I should be treating or what I shouldn't be treating with or what antiretrovirals I use or should I switch or should I not switch, just get back to the basics, screen, know what the issue is within your patient population, and then you're in a position to do something about it. Second thing then is to know what drives bone loss. And it's quite clear that the insult to bone in people living with HIV is a discrete insult, and it occurs around the time of treatment initiation. So this is one of the earliest studies from Peter Rice's group in Amsterdam to show that the first 12 months after treatment initiation, people living with HIV lose somewhere between 2 and 5% of their BMD, 2% being something similar to going through a year of the menopause. So it is a clinically significant change in BMD. Everyone loses BMD. There's not a single study that has shown that has shown zero loss at treatment initiation, but the extent of bone loss differs depending on what treatment you use. The other thing about this treatment loss is this isn't a return to norm, so it's not like people who aren't on treatment are constantly losing bone and what we're doing is stopping this loss when we start treatment. This is an effect that is associated with initiation of treatment, and this is one of the seminal findings really from the START study. You can see within the START study, those who weren't on treatment, their BMD stayed stable. Those who initiated early treatment actually lost the bone. So this is an effect of initiating treatment. Greater BMD seen with some drugs. Many studies have shown a greater increase in bone loss at treatment initiation with tenofovir disoproxil fumarate. Other studies have shown greater decreases in BMD with initiation of protease inhibitor-based regimes. So you can use this information if you know someone has low BMD to try and construct an antiretroviral regime that will be associated with less bone loss. And that's sort of common sense. In terms of integrase, it's a sort of mixed picture. If you use integrase with tenofovir disoproxil fumarate, you're getting bone loss that's probably very similar to a boosted PI. However, if you use integrase inhibitors without tenofovir disoproxil fumarate, so for example, in this study, the 104 and 111 studies that examined elvitegravir cobicistat with TDF versus elvitegravir cobicistat with TAF, you can see that in the absence of TDF, there's a much smaller bone loss with integrase inhibitors, and especially this is probably the smallest bone loss that we've seen within studies at just over 1%. Another important factor is that this is a treatment initiation at first line, but also happens with subsequent reinitiation. So this is data from the second line study from David Cooper's group in Australia. And you can see that the reinitiation of antiretroviral therapy again is associated with discrete bone loss over 48 weeks, similar in magnitude to what you would see with first-line treatment. So we can use this information in someone with low BMD to mitigate the effects of bone loss around treatment initiation. But are there other things that we can do in addition to that to prevent this bone loss from happening or to treat those with low BMD? Well, for those that are on antiretroviral therapy, there have been a number of studies that have really focused on TDF. And it's quite clear that if you switch away from TDF, that you'll increase your BMD. If you switch to TDF and you're virologically suppressed, you'll lose BMD. But the extent of bone gain and bone loss is much smaller than a treatment initiation. And really, there is really insufficient data within this field to suggest that this should be used as a treatment for low BMD. We can discuss that later. With TAF switches, again, a study looking at switch to Gemvoya, where the majority of people were switching from a TDF-based regime. Again, you get nice increases in BMD with a switch away from TDF-containing regimes to TAF of approximately 1.5%. So it's very consistent data across a range of clinical trials. Now, to really understand what additional thing we can do apart from switching antiretroviral medications, this is where the science of what's happening comes in. And there's been a lot of work that's looked at bone turnover and what happens with bone turnover treatment initiation. So bone turnover is where you can measure the balance between osteoclast activity, which leads to loss of bone, and osteoblast activity, which leads to lay down of bone. And normally, for healthy bone, these two processes are in equilibrium, so you'll get the same rate of bone resorption as you will bone formation, and that's essential for healthy bones. What happens at treatment initiation is that you get an increase in osteoclast activity very early into treatment, which coincides with the greatest loss of BMD. And subsequently, when you measure out the 12 months, the balance is reestablished with a compensatory increase in osteoblast activity, and that correlates with the stabilization of bone density. Now, the problem is at week 48 then, you got everyone on treatment having a much higher bone turnover, but you get stabilization of BMD. And what we've been able to do is to use that knowledge to try and mitigate the bone loss. So one study, it's a very straightforward intervention, in patients that were starting a TDF-based regime with efavirenz was to optimize someone's vitamin D and calcium status with vitamin D calcium supplementation. And within this study, you can see that those that received the supplementation in blue lost significantly less bone with treatment initiation than those that didn't receive the supplement. Very easy intervention that can mitigate bone loss. In addition, you can just shut down bone metabolism completely. So bisphosphonate therapy is very effective at shutting down bone metabolism. There's been a nice pilot study, again, from the US that looked at a single shot of zoledronic acid. And you can see that those that received the zoledronic acid just prior to treatment initiation, there was zero bone loss. Compared to those that didn't get the zoledronic acid, you can see the classic sort of 4% BMD loss. And this effect of zoledronic acid is driven by shutting down of bone turnover. So you can see no early rises in markers of bone resorption in those that received the drug. So this offers us two strategies that we can use to mitigate the bone loss in those that need mitigation around treatment initiation. Obviously, zoledronic acid, in my view, is a sledgehammer approach. We're currently completing a study in Dublin and with other sites around Europe, looking at a much simpler approach of generic alendronate, one tablet a day for the first 12 weeks of treatment to see if that can have a similar effect, and we hope to publish those results early next year. So finally, just maintaining bone health. An important aspect to what happens to people once they get past the 48 weeks is the message that very little happens, regardless of what antiretroviral therapy regime you're on. So this is data from the UPBEAT study. There's similar studies dating back. I think the earliest one was from Simon Malal's group in Perth back in the mid-90s that actually looked over time at people that were on fully suppressive therapy. And you can see that in blue, those with HIV, their BMD is stable over 3 years of follow-up. And although lower than their HIV negative counterparts, the rate of bone loss is exactly the same. It's no different. And this is important in terms of our concept of what we do with patients who are on stable treatment. If we go back to the Genvoya study, switching away from TDF to TAF, if you look at what happens to those subjects within these studies who remained on TDF, you can see it's a flat line. Nothing happens to the BMD. In fact, the loss that you're seeing here is slightly less than the sort of 0.9% loss that you would normally expect as a consequence of normal age-related bone loss. So switching away from antiretrovirals with a concept of avoiding greater loss of BMD, there really is no data to support that as a strategy. What we should be doing is looking beyond the drugs. Apart from that first 48 weeks, there's a lot of other things that we can use and mitigate to try and maintain bone health. Most important of these are host factors. So maintaining strength, skeletal strength, weight-bearing exercise are vitally important to maintain bone health. And there's a lot that we don't know. We've heard a lot about immune activation. The bone setup shares a lot of the immune profiles and as a consequence can be impacted by immune activation in much the same way as many other organs in the body. And this is an area of research that we're really only starting to touch on. And lastly, there's the old bad lifestyle factors. And this is really where we look at smoking. Quite recently, we've completed within the UPBEAT study an analysis looking at a trabecular bone score. And trabecular bone score is like BMD, but it measures bone microarchitecture. So rather than bone strength, this measures bone structure. And what we found was that when you model the effect of HIV on bone microarchitecture, you do get a significant association with HIV. But once you correct for smoking status, you can see that the impact of HIV is really completely abrogated. And this shows that definitely in the setting of bone microarchitecture, that smoking is an important mediator that will drive a loss of bone microarchitecture. And certainly it's another reason, above all of the other reasons, why people living with HIV should really avoid smoking. So in summary, with an older population of people living with HIV, screening is important. We can prevent or mitigate bone loss through a number of relatively simple means. There should be a focus on reversing bone loss in those that are affected using established treatments, i.e., if someone has osteoporosis, you treat them with a bisphosphonate, and you follow osteoporosis guidelines. There really is no role for active switching as a means of treating osteoporosis and HIV. And we need to also maintain a focus on healthy lifestyle as being an important component to maintain bone health as people get older. I'd just like to acknowledge the research group in Dublin that contributed to a lot of the data I've shown you today, in particular Aoife Cotter, Alina Alvarez-Barco, Tara McGinty, and Willard Tanago, who've been working on various aspects of the Upbeat study. And finally, although Marseille is beautiful in May, Dublin in June is even more fantastic, and I'd like to extend an invitation to you all to join us in Dublin at the end of June for our second annual HMRG seminar series. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Is there any questions? I would like to ask you, bone issues is not only related to aging. You know, one question I have in the clinic, there, especially people who participate in clinical trials, most of the registrational clinical trials are young people. And most of these DEXA scan data and so on are in young people. Many of these people participating in clinical trials, or even if you have the opportunity to perform DEXA scans in the clinic in young people, has low bone mineral density. And these people are not those who are supposed to be screened by EACTS guidelines and guidelines. What do you recommend? What do you do with these young people with low mineral density?
So, you know, we've had a lot of discussions within the EACTS guidelines panel about this very point. And the bottom line is, if you look at what the concept of screening is meant to do, you're meant to identify an abnormality that has a clinical consequence. And from the point of view of BMD, we don't have sufficient data within a younger population to show that the low BMD has a clinical relevance in terms of osteoporotic fracture risk. Now, we can see in young people that low BMD is associated with increased fractures in HIV, but they tend to be fractures of the wrist, fractures of the ankle, not your classic osteoporotic fractures. And the reason that we screen is because we identify a group of people that have a clinical consequence where there's an association with your screening technique, which is your DEXA, and there's an available intervention, which is bisphosphonate. So the fracture thing doesn't fit for young people, and really the safe use of bisphosphonates in younger people really hasn't been defined. So for that pragmatic reason, although we're detecting a lot of low BMD in young people with HIV, we don't recommend it as part of screening because we don't have a clear therapeutic pathway.
Regarding the DEXA scan, do you perform DEXA and TBS? Do you perform both? Do you take into account both variables to make clinical decisions?
So both variables can be derived from a single scan. So provided that you have a DEXA of your spine, you can derive TBS. The TBS data is derived from the scan itself, and what it requires is software. So a lot of modern DEXA scan facilities will actually already have the software on board where they'll be able to give you data not only on BMD but TBS. How to use TBS clinically is really, and I didn't get a chance to go through it in detail, but DEXA scans used in isolation are of limited value. What you should really do is include DEXA scans in a global risk assessment, which is called the FRAX score. And we have country-specific FRAX data, and within some of these country-specific FRAX algorithms, there's an option to include TBS. So if you do get the data and you can include it in your risk assessment, that actually optimizes your overall fracture risk prediction. And that's the best way to use TBS. Outside of global fracture risk prediction, it really is just a research tool.
Any other questions? So okay, we can move to thank you. So let's move to the next speaker. It's Rosan van Thoest. She's going to speak about dealing with more multimorbidities in HIV.